Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. At the beginning of July, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the McGirt case that established that since Congress had never de-established the Muscogee Creek Nation Reservation in eastern Oklahoma, it still actually exists, and that American Indians who are a victim of crime or accused of a crime on the reservation must be tried in federal or tribal court. Since this decision, there's been plenty of confusion on the exact scope of the decision and what it means for Oklahoma citizens and businesses located in the 11 counties that make up the Muscogee Creek Reservation. While the decision applied to criminal jurisdiction, could there be implications for civil law, regulatory, or tax law? Will it apply to other non-disestablished tribal nations in the state? A conservative think tank in the state has urged the state congressional delegation to encourage Congress to, in fact, disestablish the remaining reservations in the state. And there are worries about tribal sovereignty from tribal leaders. My guest today is Isla Haas, an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa Law School who specializes in Indian law and public health law. Prior to joining the TU Law School faculty, she taught as a visiting professor at the Indiana University McKinney School of Law and previously served as a staff attorney at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Public Health Law Program. She joins us today to talk about the Supreme Court's decision, now 4 months on since the decision was announced. Professor Haas, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's been about 4 months since the McGirt versus Oklahoma decision was handed down at the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's been a lot of confusion since, and maybe even downright misinformation on what exactly this high court decision means for citizens living in the Muscogee Creek Nation, or, and by extension, Cherokee, the Choctaw, Seminole, and Chickasaw nations, all whose borders of their reservations have not been disestablished by Congress. Has the scope of the decision now been established?
Well, the immediate implications of the decision continue to remain the same as it did when the decision came out in July. The state of Oklahoma cannot prosecute crimes involving Indians within the boundaries of the reaffirmed Muscogee Creek Nation Reservation. And instead, the federal government and the tribe have authority to prosecute. I'll add that much of the confusion regarding the decision, I feel, was a result of clickbait headlines, inaccurate information spreading across social media, and frankly, some claims made by the state of Oklahoma and other organizations on the potential harmful impact of the decision. Now, the full scope of the decision in terms of context outside of criminal law, so civil jurisdiction, does remain unclear, but that's not necessarily unusual when we're dealing with case law. Law developed by courts that establish legal precedents that need to be followed by subsequent cases. So often we see the outcome of other litigation to better see and understand the full scope of a decision.
You talked a little bit about, you could call it scare tactics or misinformation that the state has put out. What are some of the things that the state has put out that is simply not true?
I would really challenge any argument that hinges on the idea that if Oklahoma is not prosecuting these individuals for crimes committed within the boundaries of the Muscogee Creek Reservation, that we are going to see lawlessness, individuals who have committed horrid crimes released. And that is not the case. And not the case in the context of terms of the number of potential convictions that were listed in the briefings that the state of Oklahoma submitted throughout the course of the litigation, because not everyone is going to be eligible for challenging their convictions, because many defendants may choose not to challenge their convictions, which could mean that they are going to get completely retried through the federal or tribal level. And there's also this presumption, and frankly, we've seen this argument throughout the history of Indian law, where different governments are arguing that tribes or tribal courts are not equally invested in public safety, and which is just not the case. Both through the concurrent jurisdiction of the federal government and the tribal government, there is a need and a duty and a responsibility that continues to be executed across Indian country.
Now, this past week, Jim C. McGirt was, in fact, retried and convicted in federal court. Is this a sign that this decision will not have a detrimental impact on law enforcement?
Absolutely. There was so much fear-mongering leading up to this decision back when it came out in July and even after this decision. And so the suggestion that we can't expect violent criminals to be properly prosecuted is just not the case. Just in a few short months, Mr. McGirt was convicted in federal court. He was indicted back in August and retried, and that decision came swiftly. Now, there are certainly challenges in the context of transition of jurisdiction to federal and tribal court, challenges in the context of cases where post-conviction and whether defendants are eligible for relief and want relief, being able to identify that pool when potentially records don't clearly indicate whether those defendants are tribal members or considered Indian under federal law. But these challenges are not insurmountable.
Now, I guess the tribal roles are going to play a vital role on whether somebody has jurisdiction to see their case pursued in federal court or not, correct?
So concurrent jurisdiction exists between the federal government and tribes. And for the most part, when we're talking about major crimes, for those outlined under the Major Crimes Act, that concurrent jurisdiction is going to exist. Now, In terms of areas where tribal jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction could preempt federal action, there are just a small body of potential cases where that might come into play. And it really depends on what is the case at hand in the context of, is this, it is covered by the Indian Country Crimes Act, the Assimilative Crimes Act. And so there is a pool of non-major crimes that if the tribe has already prosecuted, then the federal government cannot do so. But in context of major violent crimes under federal law, that under the Federal Major Crimes Act, that's well established that that jurisdiction is concurrent. And so both the federal government and the tribe can prosecute for the same crime.
One of the things we've seen in the first few months is that some people who have been convicted in state court, you know, they're making a determination on whether they want to apply for a retrial in federal court. In some cases, federal court, perhaps the penalties are stiffer and perhaps, you know, there's less grounds for appeal from a decision in federal court than in state court.
Yes. And so that's why one under discussed issues and implications of the McGirt decision is some of these really challenging decisions for these defendants who have already been convicted about whether they risk retrial in federal court. Federal sentencing guidelines really bind federal judges in the context of what can be issued for punishment for crimes. And that scheduling is incredibly complicated and many argue very punitive. And so it may not make sense for many defendants to go through that process again. And that's a really difficult process to go through again. So asking defendants to do that, and especially when we think about, are all the defendants identified and do they have proper counsel advising them on the risks of a retrial? So these are really big decisions.
Even given all this, it seems the state is still very reluctant to give up jurisdictions for criminal acts committed by Indians or against Indians on what is now acknowledged as Indian land by the federal government. I know you've spoken with a number of representatives of the state. What's at the heart of the state's reasoning about this?
If I'm being honest, I don't know that I'm in the best position to answer this question. You know, I've already talked about some of the briefs and the arguments and frankly some of the statements to the media that different representatives across the state have discussed both before and after the decision came out, have made a variety of arguments about public safety, about the implications of civil jurisdiction, about loss of tax revenue. But frankly, none of that adds up from my perspective to the amount of hostility and animosity to tribal jurisdiction. And so I say that the root of such continued and vocal challenges to tribal jurisdiction is anti-Indian racism and anti-tribal sovereignty. This idea that tribal sovereignty can only be exercised at the expense of state rights is just a really harmful narrative, and it's pervasive, and folks believe it.
You know, there's got to be a number of other states. I know Arizona has huge reservations. Is this an issue in other states?
It is. Anti-Indian racism, anti-tribal sovereignty is pervasive, and there are citizens of states, government officials all over the country that systematically seek to resist tribal governance and tribal sovereignty. But that doesn't mean that that's universal. And we've got examples of states and local governments that have been excellent partners. And even in the context of Oklahoma, we've seen some DAs reach out to either the Muskogee Reservation or their counterparts in terms of tribes in the eastern Oklahoma to talk about the impact of this decision, and others not. I would say, in terms of big picture intergovernmental coordination, cooperation, how do we support collaboration and cooperation, avoid litigation? Well, having systems in place at the state level to ensure that tribes are consulted and supported is very important. So we know at the federal level that through executive orders that have been reaffirmed starting from the Clinton administration through the Obama administration, requiring consultation with tribes when the federal agencies are engaging in actions that's going to impact tribes or American Indians, Alaska Native people. But we have examples of state requirements for consultations too. States like New Mexico that have a state tribal collaboration act. States like Washington that have intergovernmental agreements that require consultation. And even though consultation at any level is far from perfect and there's lots of improvements, having a process where you have state agency representatives, employees well-versed and respectful of tribal authority and mechanisms in which tribes, indigenous communities have a voice in decision-making can lead to more support and collaboration long-term.
Mm. Now, in some of the Western states, you have states like New Mexico and Arizona and even California, a number of Western states where the boundaries of the reservation are well-defined, well-established, and most of the activities that occurs on the reservation are mostly tribal activities, tribal owners of the land for the most part, or some, you know, landowners that aren't, but for the most part that way. There are also states where you still have a tribal reservation that has not been disestablished, in which a whole range of diverse activities are taking place in it. Have they worked out these sort of agreements already?
The answer is yes, and it depends, right?
Okay.
There's so much variability across states and tribes. Even tribes within a state might have better, more longstanding relationships than others. But in terms of the principles of the exercise of tribal jurisdiction, in terms of criminal law and civil law, we have established laws that have been functioning all over Indian country before anyone knew about the McGirt decision. The McGirt decision did not change the authority of tribes to exercise criminal jurisdiction, or specifically the Muscogee Creek Nation. But what it did do is reaffirm a boundary that was being ignored by the state of Oklahoma for a very long time. So this is not new authority. Tribes, and frankly, the federal government, in exercising its concurrent jurisdiction, have been doing it for a very long time.
My guest today is Isla Haas. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa Law School, specializing in Indian law and health law as well. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa as we look back at the McGirt decision and what has it meant for the state, because there's so much information out there, a lot of it not necessarily correct given the scope of the decision. And there's a lot of people saying this is going to have implications on civil law, on taxation, and I thought it would be good to follow up. Now, since the decision, I assume the Creek government and the federal government have reached, either had an agreement or reached an agreement on how crimes will be prosecuted on the reservation lands. Is it going to require a beef up of the federal attorney's offices to handle the caseload, or is it not going to be that big a deal, in your view?
Well, the federal government and the Muscogee Creek Nation are exercising the concurrent jurisdiction that is a product of tribal sovereignty and federal criminal laws and case laws related to jurisdiction. And so that's going to operate independent of any agreement, because under federal law, both the federal government and the Muscogee Creek Nation have the authority to exercise this jurisdiction. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't areas that could be coordinated, especially when both the federal government and tribal governments and, frankly, state governments have discretion in terms of if and when they prosecute cases. And so there could be discussions in terms of coordinating and understanding what each government is doing in regards to certain cases or certain bodies of case types of cases. Now, staffing and resources are incredibly important. This is both in the context of prosecutions, but also on the public defense side and the administrative side. And that's going to be true both from the federal and tribal perspectives. And so my understanding is that some federal employees have been under temporary reassignments from other parts of the country in order to support the influx of cases post-McGirt. I understand that there have been new positions that have been established for federal prosecutors and federal public defenders, again, to support with this increase of cases. And I can't speak to how the Muscogee Creek Nation or the other five tribes in eastern Oklahoma implicated by this decision have adjusted their resources, but that is something that they are absolutely going to have to consider and have been, because the litigation takes a long time, especially federal litigation, especially ones where the Supreme Court granted review. And so they have been considering and planning for this for a very long time. The transition for sure is demanding, but it's not insurmountable.
Has any consensus been established or determined on whether the McGirt decision will indeed extend to other non-disestablished tribal reservations? I'm thinking of the Cherokee Nation, Choctaw, Chickasaw Nation, Seminole Nation.
So the McGirt decision was very explicit in that it said it was only going to apply to the Muscogee Creek Nation. And what it does mean is that because it clarified the existing standard for determining when Congress can diminish or disestablish a reservation, and because Congress is the only branch that has the authority, it really clarified how congressional action is going to impact reservation boundaries. And so that means that the decision or determination about whether another reservation has been diminished or disestablished is going to have to be at a tribe-by-tribe basis, and it's going to have to review congressional legislative acts and how it might impact that particular tribe's reservation. Because of the clarifying of the existing standard that was done in McGirt, we have already seen cases spring up where courts have been applying that clarified standard in, for other reservations. So we had an Oklahoma trial court in a criminal law case find that the Seminole Nation has not been disestablished and is indeed Indian country, so the state is not going to have jurisdiction. In another criminal law case, the Oklahoma appeals found that the Chickasaw Nation has not been disestablished, again, applying the reaffirmed principles in McGirt. We've also have cases for other tribes, including Cherokee Nation, pending, and we have cases in other parts of the for tribes in other parts of the country. So a federal Seventh Circuit decision found that reaffirmed a treaty reservation boundaries for the Oneida Reservation, not in a criminal law case, but in the case of civil jurisdiction. And so we're seeing other pending litigation across other courts in other parts of the country as well.
That's one question I wanted to ask was, has McGirt been cited by other tribes asserting control of their treaty reservation lands where similarly they haven't been disestablished, but the tradition within the state has been to ignore the reservation boundaries?
That's exactly right. And the language in McGirt was very clear in the standard in which courts can determine whether Congress has disestablished a reservation and emphasized above all congressional language over other factors like what's referred to in these cases as the Indian character in terms of how many tribal members or Indians are living within the boundaries of the reservation, the ownership status of those lands. And Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority in McGirt, said that's not going to matter if the congressional language is clear. And in many cases, the congressional language is clear, and sometimes it just needs to be litigated so that those reservation boundaries can be reaffirmed.
It seems like Justice Gorsuch in his decision basically said it's up to Congress and Congress alone to disestablish the reservation. And until it does, it doesn't matter how much time has passed and whether the federal government or the state governments have abided by the conditions of the treaty that established the reservation still exists.
That's exactly right. There's a quote from the majority decision that has been a favorite amongst citizens, tribal citizens, Indian law scholars, advocates, allies, and it's, quote, unlawful acts performed long enough and with sufficient vigor are never enough to amend the law. To hold otherwise would be to elevate the most brazen and longstanding injustices over the law, both rewarding wrong and failing those in the right. One of the reasons why this decision is so important to tribal citizens, tribes, Indian country, and their allies is because of the very clear and elegant prose that Justice Gorsuch used writing for the majority. And this is a great example of that. He says, again, writing for the majority, that it doesn't matter how long the law has been broken. And courts should not affirm illegal acts as legal just because they've been done for a long time. And I think that speaks to some of the longest standing injustices that the United States has perpetuated, especially in the context of genocide of Native people.
I want to ask you, there's a conservative think tank in our state that's been prominent in recent days in pushing the state's congressional delegation to, in fact, urge Congress to disestablish the remaining reservations in the state. It's a big if Congress passed the legislation. What would be the impact on the tribes and their governments?
So the impact is going to largely depend on the language of the legislation, if it did, in fact, disestablish a reservation or somehow limited the exercise of tribal sovereignty, either in the context of criminal law or civil law. But I will say legislation is strongly disfavored across Indian country. That kind of legislation would run afoul the federal government's treaty and trust responsibility to tribes. It would take the country back to an era where the federal government, through congressional action, was actively and openly trying to terminate tribes, take away their land bases that it has been guaranteed by treaty, which is considered the supreme law of the land under the Constitution. So I think that would be a very aggressive act by Congress and highly disfavored, and a gross miscarriage of justice if Congress allowed this to happen, because some people find tribal sovereignty inconvenient politically or financially.
And as we well know, in this state, there's a lot of issues beyond just criminal law that's at the heart of the conflict between the state and tribal governments. A lot of it has to do with gaming revenue and gaming control, and those issues are a part of the sort of undercurrent of this current dispute, I would have to say.
I agree. And a lot of this idea of post-migrant chaos has cited implications beyond criminal law. But first and foremost, these implications are speculative. We do not yet know how they are going to pan out. There's also this presumption that implication beyond criminal law is automatically bad or harmful or grossly unfair. Tribes exercise their sovereignty to pass and enforce laws that protect their land and their people. And strength in tribal governance and community doesn't just support the well-being of tribal citizens, but the welfare of all of Oklahoma. Even though there are implications, and even though there could be shifts in governance potentially related to environmental law issues or taxation law issues, that is just a function of existing in a country that has multiple forms of government with different regulatory authority. The federal government, or frankly the state of Oklahoma, could change their laws at any point, and folks are going to be subject to them. And just because tribal jurisdiction in the context of criminal law or potentially civil law has not been recognized by the state of Oklahoma doesn't mean that that authority hasn't existed all the time. And a really good example of how cooperation could be a better tactic than fear-mongering or trying to knock on Congress's door and ask them to infringe on tribal sovereignty or tribal land rights. Think about what cooperation can do. So just a few days ago, the Muscogee Creek Nation passed a law legalizing marijuana under its criminal code if the activity is legal under Oklahoma's statutory and regulatory scheme. So the tribe and the tribe's commission appointed post-McGirt to consider potential implications in civil and other areas of law, identified legalization of medical marijuana from the state perspective as impacting their sovereignty and their citizens, especially when you might have, as been highlighted by some other experts and attorneys in the state, you might have someone who is a non-Indian, non-tribal member married to a tribal member. Mm. And that might mean that within the boundaries of the reservation, meaning that one of them can legally, under Oklahoma law, use medical marijuana, but the tribal member potentially could not. And so this was a fix that the tribe identified and executed. And this could be an opportunity to identify other areas and come to resolutions that are going to serve the interest of more than just one party or one community.
I do have to ask you about a recent decision where last month the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal of an Oklahoma Supreme Court decision that said counties can't collect taxes on business renting equipment to a tribal gaming operation. This has been a long suit in our state, and Justice Thomas cited the McGirt decision, saying the court needed to address the scope and limitations of the McGirt decision. And again, so the McGirt decision came back up into the public eye again. Is this a legitimate question on the part of one justice of the Supreme Court, or is it, you know, just something out there?
It's a legitimate question regarding the impact of McGirt in context of civil jurisdiction.
And this gets into taxation, right? I mean, this was a taxation question.
It's a taxation issue on a business that was renting gaming equipment to a tribal gaming enterprise. Now, I would even go on to say that what Justice Thomas did in his dissent for the Supreme Court's decision not to review the case, he had also talked about some of the inconsistency in Supreme Court case law related to the standards for adjudicating challenges to civil jurisdiction in Indian country. And many Indian law scholars would agree that these standards can be a bit unpredictable and inconsistent. So what I don't think is necessarily legitimate, and why I do think it was fear-mongering and a bit of a red herring that Justice Thomas decided to cite the McGirt case, is because this case had been decided without having anything to do with McGirt. The case at issue focused on preemption of federal gaming laws on the taxation of this gaming equipment. The Oklahoma Supreme Court found against the county that was trying to tax. In 2019, that decision came out. So before the McGirt decision was even issued in July 2020, the petition where the county challenged that decision and asked the Supreme Court to review it was submitted before the McGirt decision was issued. The county in the proceedings agreed that the equipment was located in Indian country, so it didn't even implicate Indian land in the way that McGirt reaffirmed them. So the fact that Justice Thomas went out of his way to express his displeasure with the McGirt decision, I thought was incredibly unfair for a decision that would not have hinged on McGirt in any way.
Well, it seems like there's still a lot of hostility to the idea of Indian sovereignty.
Exactly right. There has been a growing over the last few decades. I mean, this sentiment has existed in this country since colonization, but anti-Indian sovereignty and racism, and organizations that are getting more and more power to challenge tribal sovereignty in areas like taxation, in areas like Indian child welfare. And these are concerted efforts on the part of these organizations and their allies to litigate issues, knowing that federal courts might be hostile to tribal interests. And it is incredibly unfortunate, again, because it is based on the narrative that tribes cannot or should not exercise jurisdiction, and somehow when they do, that it is going to be harmful to others. And that's just not the case.
Professor Isla Haas is an assistant professor of law at the University of Tulsa Law School, specializing in Indian law and public health law. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.